My name is Keiko Sagami. I'm with the University of Montana, and I'm interviewing Adam McCaw. It's November 14th, 2014, and we are in Missoula, Montana. Okay. It's McCaw, right?
Correct. Yeah.
That's what I thought. Okay. So can I just get you to introduce yourself with your positions within the military?
Sure. So when I got out of the military, I was a staff sergeant, a special forces weapons sergeant. My name is Adam McCaw. I was with 7th Special Forces Group out of Eglin Air Force Base in Florida. I served roughly 8 years, four of which were with Special Forces, two were in Special Forces training, and then an additional roughly two were with 4th Infantry Division. Out of Fort Hood, Texas.
Okay, so where were you born?
Greenville, Texas.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then who are your parents and what are their occupations?
Bill McCaw is my dad. He owns an insurance company, small one, back home. My mom, Ann Tate, she taught for a long, long time, and she's retired now. And yeah.
Okay. Do you have any siblings?
I do. I have one brother, Matt. He lives in Austin, Texas. He's a biologist.
Okay. And did any of your immediate family serve in the military?
My grandfather was in, on my mom's side, was in the Navy for like a year, back in the '40s. And then my other grandfather was, I think he was in the Navy also. They both did, like, super, super short little times of service. I think my grandfather on my mom's side was a typist. He always used to, like, laugh about that. So, yeah. So that's pretty much it.
Okay. What were you doing before you joined?
I was in college. I was at Texas Tech University. I was studying biology there and wasn't feeling it, so... I knew I could always come back, and I always wanted to kind of travel and to really decide for myself what was really happening in the world at that time. I was kind of tired of reading the news and hearing people talk about it. I wanted to figure it out for myself. So
did that have a lot of influence on why you chose to join the service, or was there another reason?
I don't know. I've always been a fan of the outdoors. I've always kind of wanted to push myself, or I don't know. There was kind of a thing going on where, you know, especially whenever we went into Iraq, I was seeing 18-year-old kids on the news, and they were, you know, either shot up or they were tired and hungry and missed home, and I was like, what, you know, what makes me so special? I'm, you know, I'm older than them. I've kind of seen a little bit more than they have. It's not fair, you know, that you have guys that are doing so much and I'm barely passing my classes in college, and all I'm concerned about is like the next social event or something like that. And the people I was hanging around with weren't concerned about with any world events that were going on, and so I wanted to do my part.
Okay. So how old were you when you joined?
I was 22.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then why did you specifically choose your branch of the military?
So I knew I wanted to be in the infantry. So that essentially narrows it down to the Marine Corps or the Army. But within the Army, you can really branch out from the infantry and specialize. You can be you can be with an airborne unit and jump out of planes. You can be an Army Ranger and do what they do. You can be a Special Forces soldier. You can and then you can even go into you know, counterterrorism stuff like with Delta Force, and that there's just way more options, way more schools. And in my opinion at the time, it was if I decided to get out of the military with all the schools that I had potentially would be able to potentially accrue in the Army, I could pursue a three-letter agency, you know, like CIA, FBI, or, you know, Department of Homeland Security, something like that. So.
Okay. So what happened when you departed from training camp and just within your early days of training?
So my family threw me a party. A lot of family members that I hadn't seen in a long time came. I left Texas, went to Fort Benning, Georgia. That's the home of the infantry. That's where you train. And in Fort Benning, I was there for a total of 12 weeks. But the first 2 weeks, there were so many people that were enlisting in the military at that time that they didn't have spots for us. So there was a holding bay, pretty much. So there's, you know, a couple thousand soldiers there, soon to be soldiers. And so we pretty much just got up at 6 in the morning. We weren't doing any physical training. They were just feeding us and letting us go back and, like, mop the floor. And then we would go eat lunch, and then they'd come back and, like, sweep or mop the floor and then go eat dinner. And then they didn't want us getting hurt. They just wanted us fed and quiet and getting ready for training. And then 12 weeks of after that, after those 2 weeks of holding, 12 weeks of running and continuous push-ups and training and marching and sleeping out in the field, just doing all the Army stuff that you do. And then I finished basic training. I went on 30 days. They gave us 30 days of leave. So I went home for 30 days. I reported to Fort Hood, Texas, and then 2 weeks later, I was in Kuwait. So it was really quick. It happened fast, which I was happy for. I'm not a good, they call it a garrison soldier, which is that's where you're, if you're in the United States, you're in garrison. So I'm not a good garrison soldier. I get bored and it's not fun. I don't like to play Army. I would rather do the real thing, so.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So what did your family think of you enlisting?
My mom was distraught. She was sad. She was kind of, initially she was pretty destroyed. But then I don't know if she ever really got over that, but she, quit showing it and then became very, you know, she was very, very proud. It's embarrassing. Like, you would go to the grocery store with her and she would like tell the person at the checkout counter, like, "Oh yeah, my son, blah, blah, blah." But Dad, he was cool with it. I mean, right off the bat, he was all about it. He grew up in the late 60s and 70s and when Vietnam was going on. And even though he really didn't have a desire, I mean, I don't think he believed in the war. And he was seeing a lot of his friends not coming back from there. But just the culture of a male, especially from the South, I think it's kind of ingrained in you to be a good Southerner, maybe, and go fight. I don't know, but he was cool with it. So, and he was glad that I could get out and then go back to school and not be really dependent upon anything else. I could kind of pave my own way.
Okay. So with your mom being so upset about it, did that really affect the way you thought going into it?
Initially it did. I didn't want to join the military due to that fact. But I talked to friends of mine that had already joined, that were in the military then, and they pretty much broke it down and said, "Man, it's your life. You do what you do. You do what you do. There's always going to be somebody who's not going to be extremely happy with the decisions that you make, but those are your decisions and you need to accept that," and they will then in turn they will accept it. So
okay.
So can you tell me a little bit about the specialized training you received?
Mm-hmm. So in the Q course, in the qualification course is what they call it, you try out to go. And so I tried out. And the tryout period is 24 days. It's in Fort Bragg. It's pretty brutal. It's relatively no sleep, relatively no food. You're continuously carrying weight on your back, like a, 45, 50-pound pack, and you're always moving, 10 kilometers here, and then you get to that location, and they have, a certain little scenario for you, then you move another 12 kilometers. So on any given day, you're moving 30, 40 kilometers a day, so pretty far. But so I made it through that. I got selected, and you go to a month of leadership. It's essentially like a prep course for to become a sergeant or a non-commissioned officer. And then after that, you go to 4 months of language. And then you go to 2 months of small unit tactics. And what that is we're learning how to move in the woods with, 12 guys quietly and quickly and conduct operations. And then you go to a month of SEER school, which SEER school is survival, evade, resist, and escape. And that's where you learn how to resist capture and survive in the woods. And if you do get captured by the enemy, how to conduct yourself as a prisoner of war and how to say certain things in order to not say other things. Because when you're getting interrogated and all this kind of stuff. And then it was... 4 months of job training, which my job was weapons. So I learned all the weapons of all the NATO forces and even non-NATO forces. Tactics, that was my thing, was tactics as a weapons sergeant. And so you could get deployed to another country, walk into a village, pick up the AK-47, know more about it than the villager does, and immediately build, you have instant rapport with that villager or soldier. And then a month of Robin Sage. And Robin Sage was a culmination exercise where you put all of your training and your all the things that you've learned and all the things that they want you to know into a real world, quote unquote, scenario in the woods of North Carolina. So, that's kind of the training I received.
Okay, so why Special Forces?
Special Forces are kind of a special little entity. They work in small teams, a 12-man team. It's called an ODA, or an Operational Detachment Alpha. And they're completely self-sustainable. So you have a captain, you have a team sergeant, you have a warrant officer, you have an intelligence sergeant, you have two engineer sergeants, and what they do is they build and they blow things up. Then you have two weapons sergeants. You have two medics, which the medics are the most highly trained medics in the entire military. And as far as trauma goes, they can work on... they're trained in veterinary skills, dental, trauma, you name it. You get hit by a car on the side of the road, you push that surgeon out of the way, and you reach for that 18 Delta or that Special Forces medical sergeant. And then you have two communication sergeants. So with that assortment of soldiers, you can be thrown into any scenario in the entire world with what's on your back and accomplish, you know, leaps and bounds above, in my opinion, any other entity around. I mean, that's why essentially a handful of CIA guys, a handful of Delta Force guys, and, you know, I think it was like two or three teams of Special Forces soldiers dropped into northern Afghanistan. I mean, they essentially took it to the Taliban and did great things. And so, they're small, they're self-sustainable, they think for themselves, they're highly trained, and they're considered to be quiet professionals, so they're not braggadocious for the most part. And it's just kind of a different way of thinking, in my opinion, which I wanted to see if it was a reality instead of just a preconceived notion.
Okay, so all about just what they did and everyone that was involved, that you just found that appealing to?
Correct, yeah. I didn't want to be a part of a unit that was, you know, that was a chest pounder or a look at how cool I am group of guys, or extremely worried about uniform standards and haircuts and things like that. I just wanted to be with a group of guys that were mission oriented, and everything else is kind of comes second. And that's what those guys are. I mean, they focus on the mission and they accomplish it.
Okay. So for the record, can you say exactly where you served?
Yeah. I was in right outside of Baghdad for a year with 4th Infantry Division. And then I went to Oruzgan Province with 7th Special Forces Group. And then I was in Kandahar Province with 7th Special Forces Group. And then I was in Colombia with 7th Special Forces Group.
Okay. And what kind of friendships and camaraderie did you form while serving? And, like, with whom did you form the closest?
Yeah, it's interesting because in the little cultural cliques that you grow up with, you grow up in as a kid, you associate yourself with people that maybe you have things in common with, or maybe they look like you, or maybe they live in the same neighborhood. Well, it's funny because in the Army, it's not how it works. You make best friends with guys that you would have otherwise never even spoken to, and it's kind of a running joke. So you have like a Jamaican dude and a Chinese guy. Like, the Jamaican dude is like 6'5", like 225, and the Chinese guy is like 5'2", 135 pounds, and they become best buds. You know, it's always the odd couple. You know, it's really funny, but it's also off-putting too, because you would go through a month-long training scenario with a group of guys, and, you know, you don't even know their parents' names, but you know everything about this individual. You know what he looks like when he walks through the woods at night. You know what his cough sounds like. You know everything about this person, besides all the things you would know about him if you would have spent your entire life with him. But you've only known him for a month, and if your car broke down, you could call that person and they would drive across the United States to come get you and help you out. But you're supposedly your best friends from back home. You can't even get a hold of them on the phone. Like, they don't answer your phone calls. They don't, you know, it's always about what's in it for me. And that's unfortunate. And that's really the great thing about serving in the military, is that you really figure out that there are people out there that can depend on you at the drop of a hat, and you can depend on them, and that's really what it's about. But yeah, I made some really good friends in the military. Still talk to a lot of them. And it's also funny because the guys that are sometimes the best in combat, or the when things really, really get bad, you don't take those guys home to meet your parents. Like, sometimes you don't even want to be seen in public with them, because they're interesting human beings, and but you can count on them for anything, and they're just a little rough around the edges, so.
Okay, so can you give me an example of a time when someone you were close with in one of your groups, mm-hmm. you guys either helped each other or it really, like, helped you, like, bond together?
It's kind of, there's so many, there's millions of scenarios that are kind of running through my mind, but, like, for instance, during the selection phase, the 24-day phase, like, guys' feet are, you know, beat up and bleeding, and they're from walking so much, and you hadn't taken a shower in a long time, and so you're just breaking down physically and mentally, and you know, I saw one of my good friends give his last pair of socks, you know, to another friend of ours, and that's like the equivalent in the civilian world of like giving a bar of gold to someone. So those are small things, but they complete and utter selflessness is what I experienced a lot in the military. And that's the good thing about Special Forces too, is that those are the individuals that get selected. Those are the individuals that try, and they want to spend their time wisely, and they want to be around people that are like-minded, and that's what you end up with. You have people that you get peered, you get graded by your peers. So once a week, or, you know, once every couple of days, we would have to fill out this little form talking about, hey, which guy would you want to be in combat with? And, you know, it's not the strongest guy. It's not the fastest guy. It's not the you know, it's none of those things. The Rambo character or the Arnold Schwarzenegger character, those guys fall to the wayside. It's the people that that help each other out. It's the people that can maintain their cool under pressure, and it's those are the individuals that, yeah, I can't really think of another, like, specific, you know, millions of times I've not millions of times, but multiple times I've called people, hey man, can you give me a ride to the airport in 5 minutes? Of course, you know. Or, hey, I got a flat. No worries, man, I'll be there in a second. Or, oh, a good friend of mine, when we got back from Colombia, my truck tire was flat in the parking lot. And as soon as the bus rolled up and we were going to, you know, get off the bus and clean equipment and do whatever, I saw a good friend of mine in the parking lot airing up my tire to my truck. And that he came back early. I think his wife had a baby, so he came back a couple weeks early. So he noticed that my truck tire was flat, and he brought his electric air pump, I think it was. So he was airing on my tire. Good guy.
Okay. Was there ever a time in combat you can remember that anyone really did something very selfless and sincere for you?
Maybe come back to that question. I don't know. Let me think about that for a minute.
Okay, no, that's fine.
Yeah.
So while you were overseas, how did you keep in, or even in training, how did you keep in contact with those at home, mm-hmm. friends or family?
In Iraq, we were on a pretty big military base, and you could buy a phone card. And so if it didn't interfere with anything, you could kind of run down to the little phone station and make a call. A lot of letters, though. I received a lot of mail. In Afghanistan, the first time, we were pretty isolated, so we weren't receiving mail for most of it, if I can remember correctly. And we weren't making phone calls either because we were we only had satellite phones, and it's expensive to use satellite phones. Which it's kind of good. It's kind of, in my opinion, I really liked those days when you could, or those months when you just focused on what it's an interesting little dynamic on deployments, because you can completely turn off all the petty stuff maybe that's going on back home. I mean, granted, yeah, you miss your family, but you don't have to listen to your girlfriend gossip about so-and-so, even though you miss her, but you can just focus on what's truly important, in my opinion, and that was making sure your buddies were okay and making sure that you accomplished your mission. But the second time in Afghanistan, I could make phone calls whenever I wanted, and for the most part, and receive mail. And in South America, I mean, guys had cell phones, so, but I didn't use a cell phone, but you could receive mail or make a, you know, send emails and whatnot, so.
Okay, yeah. So did you ever receive any care packages?
Yes, I did, a lot. My family was pretty good about sending stuff, and I really didn't ask for much. Okay. Actually, ever, I didn't really ask for anything ever, but it kind of trickles through the community, especially from a small town. It's like, he said he likes beef jerky, so then you get like 17 boxes of beef jerky from people you don't know. So it's kind of, it's one of those things.
What's your favorite thing you've ever received in a care package?
My mom makes toffee, and I don't even think I finished eating it. I mean, it was a big bag of toffee, and I would, like, hide it from myself, you know, and then, like, because whenever I would open the bag, I would eat, like, 6 pieces. So, toffee, yeah, probably toffee. And then my buddy's mom sent a care package with, like, a whole bunch of random items in it, and one had a, you know, a big bag of water balloons. So that was fun because we just destroy everybody that came in contact with us with water balloons. All our buddies, you know. Yeah, my dad would send magazines and stuff, which was always great. And then, yeah, those are probably the top three, I imagine.
Okay, so was the water balloons just like a nice little break from reality for a second?
Yeah, because when you have a birthday in the Army, it's not fun for you. You try to keep all of the little intimate things about yourself hidden because they will be exploited immediately. So on your birthday, you always get attacked. And so, somebody somewhere, I think it was from a church, they sent a box of like women's garments, of like undergarments and like scarves, and I guess they wanted us to pass them out to the villagers or something like that. I don't know, but we didn't do that. We found out that it was one of our buddies' birthdays, so we tackled him and we duct taped his hands and feet and held him down, and then we just dressed him up in all of the women's garments and bras and panties and put makeup all over him, and like, you know, I don't know if we had a wig or like a mop or something that we made it. And then we drug him over to our platoon sergeant's door, and he was kind of a hard ass, and we duct taped him to a concrete pillar and then knocked on his door and ran away. And so that's kind of like what you do on people's birthdays, like you get beat up, or we shaved one guy's eyebrows, and I don't know, it's funny, but I can't remember what the question was. Yeah.
That's okay. So how did you return home?
Physically, mentally, how did I travel?
Yeah, that and what was it like coming back?
So in Iraq, it was constant IEDs. It was IEDs every single day. And so with that being said, when I came back from Iraq, I don't know, it's like 23. That was the hardest time. That was the hardest deployment to return from, in my opinion. It was my first deployment. It was my first time to leave the country for that extended period of time. It was a year long, so it was hard. It was about a month. I'd say for about a month, my buddy David Camacho and I, we were roommates. It was like every hour on the hour, you know, we'd wake up and like look around, or we had issues. I kind of had issues driving down the street because, you know, if I saw a trash bag or something on the side of the road, or I wouldn't freak out, but I would definitely like grit my teeth and kind of like, ugh. And then I remember that I'm not in Iraq anymore. So luckily I could kind of turn it off maybe after I felt some sort of danger, but, I drank a lot. That's kind of, but I was still young, so I guess that I probably maybe would have been doing that anyway, but, I guess I was trying to make up for lost time by doing as much as I possibly could, having as much fun as I possibly could, I guess, but then, you know, most of the trips back from Afghanistan, I'd say the last one, I thought that I was fine. I was like, oh, I'm fine. I'm cool. There's nothing. There's no issues. But it was kind of like a silent creeper. I guess I was okay. Everything was good. But there was definitely, but it was also paired with the fact that I was getting out of the military. So, not only did I just get back from Afghanistan, but I was getting out of the military. So there was like two big life transitions right there that I was dealing with. Because it's easy just to stay in the military whenever you come back from deployment, because you can spend time with your buddies and y'all are going through the similar things. But if you come back from a deployment and you get out of the military at the same time, you're thrown back into the civilian sector essentially on your own. And so for however long you've been in the military, you've had leadership or instructors or anybody that you kind of respect telling you that this is the way that it has to be. This is the standard. And if you live by this standard, you'll be successful. Everything will be okay. You'll stay alive. Your buddies will stay alive. It'll be great. Well, when you come back into the civilian world, there's multiple ways of doing things, hundreds of ways, all of which are okay. And that's hard for a military service member, I think, to kind of deal with is, yeah, so. So that's probably the thing that I had issues with was, it's kind of realizing, okay, there are other ways of doing things. And if someone does something that's different than the way you do it, that's fine. It's, you're not deployed anymore. It's okay.
Okay. So can you take me on a tour of that day when you got back and you were done with the military?
Mm-hmm.
Can you take me on a tour of coming back home and just what happened?
Mm-hmm.
Just describe it to me as if I was like blind.
Okay. So I got back from Afghanistan, but then I had, I don't know, roughly a month to out process, to get out of the army. But when you... Special Forces is kind of funny because we do things that are we don't really like to receive praise. And so it's like in the middle of the night and you just show up at a you know, you get off the plane. We took a military plane, so we didn't have to deal with airports. And sometimes you fly plain clothes, you don't fly in uniform. We got back and it was late at night, and we got on a military bus, and they took us to our company area, or battalion area, and we got off, and there were some family members there, and pretty much you just get your bag and you kiss your family member or whoever's there to see you, and you just kind of get in your vehicle and you drive away. And it's kind of a little surreal, but that's there's so many guys that have been on half a dozen deployments. I mean, they kind of get tired of the little parades and stuff. But it was just a month, I guess you could say it's just a month of getting your paperwork ready to get out and turning in equipment. But I remember driving from Florida to Texas with you know, some items in my vehicle, and just kind of thinking to myself, wow, like it's over, which I was ready for it. My opinion of the war and how we were kind of running it and was changing. So I was, and my beliefs were changing, and so I was ready to get out. It was time. So it's kind of a good feeling. I mean, it was. Yeah, the only thing that I ever worried about missing, and the only thing that I really ever miss, are my buddies. And being with your buddies on a deployment and having the ability and the means to make sound decisions and carry them out regardless of what happens is kind of like the ultimate experience in my mind. And a lot of guys can't get over that. And that's why a lot of guys don't get out. And that's why a lot of guys go back in once they've gotten out. But it's not always that good. So there's a lot of downfalls to it. So luckily I was able to keep that in mind, that it's not always fun. So
okay. Have you kept in contact with a lot of your fellow veterans, or have you reunited with any of them?
I talked to a few guys that I was in Iraq with, because a lot of them are out, and so they have regular schedules. Really, the guys that are still in Special Forces, their schedules are so fast and so unpredictable that you really can't call them. And I mean, you can send emails if you want, but they're so busy. And but there's a handful of guys that I talk to that are still in SF that we keep up with each other. And a few of them are going to come visit. One of them is already come and visited Missoula, and I have another friend who's coming out to go skiing this year. So yeah, you kind of keep in touch with the ones that you really had a relationship with. So,
okay. Yeah. Do you have any intentions of returning to the military?
No. I had thoughts of it, and I thought I wanted to return, but it's a really, really hard life, and it's it's a fulfilling life. You get to travel a lot, and you get to see a lot. But it's for me specifically. Those were a good couple of chapters. There were a couple of really interesting chapters, but there's more to this book than just doing 20 years or 30 years in the military and then kind of like being in my 50s and scratching my head and wondering what I'm gonna do. So. No, I don't have any plans of returning.
Okay. So can you tell me about the best and the worst day you had in the service when you were overseas?
Best day. Maybe the best day, but it might have even been anticlimactic, was when I received my Green Beret and my Special Forces tab. That, I mean, if I had to put if I had to just pick one, or maybe when I got selected for selection, that was a good day. Getting, you know, really for 24 days straight, hard, taxing time. And then they'd say, okay, you have what it takes. That was a good day. Or, you know, when I graduated from the Q course, that was a good day. Worst day. I don't know. It's funny. I could probably think of one, but you really don't remember a lot of the bad stuff. I've had issues with that. I've talked to buddies of mine and they're like, oh man, do you remember that time? And I don't. I don't remember it. Or I would ask them, oh man, do you remember that time? That was crazy. That was a terrible day. And they're like, no, I don't remember that at all. So I guess it has something to do with maybe the human brain and how we adapt and how we maybe push bad things out. But, and it's also weird too, because a bad day can almost be considered as like a glorious day. Like you see gore and people dying, and maybe you're killing people, and maybe there's things happening all around you that some people would consider to be terrible. But sometimes military service members consider those to be good days. So it's an interesting dynamic, especially with individuals that are seeking glory, that are seeking that they're pushing the envelope constantly, and they're really trying to feel something. And that's also another thing that's interesting about the military, is that I think it's composed of a lot of people that are really trying to feel something dramatic. They want to see something dramatic. They want to feel drama. They want to feel something intense. And so, yeah, I don't know. I can't really. My worst day was probably some day where I was having to do paperwork all day long. That was probably my worst day in the Army, which that happens a lot in Special Forces, because you have so much responsibility as an individual. And so you're having to do a lot of administrative stuff behind the scenes in order to make something happen. So okay, I probably can tell you my worst day. So I was in scuba training and learning to become essentially a diver, a combat diver. And they call it pre-scuba, and you go to pre-scuba for 2 weeks, and then you go to Florida, to Key West, Florida, I believe, for 6 weeks for the actual school. But the two-week prep course is pretty tough, because there's not a lot of easing you into it. And I had no idea that I had kind of issues with water. I didn't know that. I loved water all my life. But so you go from not knowing how to swim 50 meters underwater to, hey, you need to go and swim from this side of the pool to the other side of the pool and then come back without taking a breath. Okay. So, yeah, I didn't make it through that. And so I quit, actually. It was, you know, like a week into the prep course, and I quit. And I had to tell, you know, my leadership, and I had to tell the people that were on my team, hey, I don't have what it takes. I got some issues. So That was probably my worst day, yeah.
Okay. And so, did you come in contact with a lot of civilians when you were serving overseas?
Yes. In Special Forces, you learn how to navigate the human terrain, and the human terrain is the hardest to navigate. So you're continuously dealing with civilians and talking to them about what they need or what the enemy activity is in the area, or hey, that loud explosion last night, that was us, sorry. Or sorry, whenever we flew our helicopter over your house yesterday, we scared your cow or something. Like, you're always talking to the civilians and you're always building a positive relationship with them, or you're trying to reestablish a positive relationship. That's why in Special Forces you're taught languages. Like, I learned multiple languages for different areas of the world that I was operating in. And same to be said for the other guys on my team. You're culturally trained and you're linguistically trained to deal with civilians constantly, because what we're seeing is that you don't have an army on one side of a trench and another army on the other side in a trench. It's not happening anymore. It's all guerrilla warfare. So that civilian that you drive through his wheat field and you tear it up, yesterday he was your friend. Today he's your enemy. You just destroyed all of his crops. And the only way he can make money now is by maybe emplacing IEDs for the Taliban. Like, that's what we were seeing. So you're constantly trying to maintain a positive relationship with people that you're living with. So,
okay. Can you tell me about a time when you maybe specifically interacted with a civilian and then maybe built a relationship and then had that torn apart for some reason?
So my last trip to Afghanistan, we were training, we were living in a village and we were training local villagers in multiple villages in the area how to become Afghan local police, so they could farm during the day and then put on a uniform, pick up a gun, and patrol their streets and maintain security. And they were getting paid to do that. They were farmers and police officers. They were making more money. They were happy. So anyway, I was running that training program. So guys would come to me for a month and I would train them from anywhere from 5 people to, 25 people. And some individuals wouldn't be good at their job. I mean, they were, they had issues, or they had attitude, or they maybe they did something that was unsafe. I don't know. Multiple reasons, but so there was a couple of guys that I had to fire and during training, and they're working hard. They want to do this thing, but for some reason they don't have what it takes. And I didn't think that it would be responsible to put someone in a position of authority in a village with a gun at night, walking around in the street, if they can't even like turn to the left. If you ask them to turn to the left, like, there's something going on there, and maybe too much, too many hits off the old opium pipe. Maybe turn the, that card. But so I've had to fire. I had to fire a few guys, and it was ugly, and walk them to the gate, and you know, blah blah blah. But I always made it a point to go to their village and smooth things over and talk to them and invite them back to our village and sit down with them and talk. And because those are the most dangerous people in my mind, are people that in Afghanistan especially that maybe hold a grudge, or that you in some way insulted their honor to their family. Because if you fire a male, or if you say a male is undeemed or seen as incapable of accomplishing something in Afghanistan, they lose credibility, and that's, they're a tribal culture, and if you lose credibility in a tribal culture, it's very detrimental. So I always try to restore that by saying, hey, you might not be the best person for this specific job, but that doesn't mean that you're not the best person for other things. Just, you know, I'm sorry it didn't work out, but, and then we would go to their village and things would be cool, and we would drink tea and we would still be buddies. So, but yeah, I never had an instance. It's too dangerous to leave things, without being smoothed over, because that's the guy that's going to step out from behind a tree with a gun one day. So, and you know, it might be 5 years down the road and he shoots some 18-year-old kid, some American. So you don't let that happen.
Okay.
Yeah.
So speaking of your first day overseas, your very first day touching down, can you explain to me the feelings that were going through your mind and just take me through exactly what happened when you got there?
Yeah. First day ever, I landed in, it's called Camp Taji. Camp Taji was like 6 miles or so north of Baghdad, and Baghdad proper. So essentially we were still within the confines of Baghdad technically, but we landed in a Chinook helicopter. There was, I don't know, 25 people of us on this helicopter, and we get off and you can't hear anything. It was my first time on a helicopter. I really don't know if it's safe. You know, instructions really weren't passed, I guess, or maybe they were, maybe this is one of those things that I forgot. I don't know, but, so I'm just trying to grab all my equipment and get off this helicopter and, without getting yelled at by somebody, or, it's dark, it's nighttime, and, you're supposed to put this, your equipment and your bags on this truck and then get on the truck. I definitely remember the feeling of getting off this helicopter. It's dark. I didn't know if, like, are we going to start receiving fire? Like, or is, you know, all you hear about on the news is, yeah, Baghdad is this really dangerous place. I didn't know if we were going to start getting shot at. I didn't know. So, but then you kind of have like this weird feeling of safety. And I've felt it a bunch before, especially when I was a young soldier. It's like, as long as you're with your other fellow soldiers and your leadership is there, like, really, you'll be fine. And that's kind of what I felt. So, but I was definitely trying not to get yelled at for like moving too slow or not putting my bag in the right spot, or, yeah. So you're really paying attention. You see everything. Your situational awareness is like on, you know, level 10. So.
Okay. How are you going to remember this experience, or how do you remember this experience?
It seems like a lifetime ago, but I'll remember my experiences in the military as experiences that really grew me as a person rapidly. I try to put it into like an equation or something. If I would have done all of this on my own, maybe without, you know, it would have taken, I lived a lifetime in 7.5 years, with the amount of travel, with the amount of experiences, and not all of them were good, but every one of them I learned from. And all the people that you meet from every single state, every single place in the United States, along with all the other people from around the world that have joined the U.S. military to serve and to become citizens, and all the people you work with all over the world, it's and the things and the smells and the food and the, it's essentially enabled me to figure out who I am by exposing me to hundreds and thousands and different scenarios and things like that. So it was a really interesting building experience.
Okay. What was your proudest moment?
It probably could have been when I graduated from the Q course. Well, I don't know. When I went to selection and I made it, I had to go back to my old unit in the 4th Infantry Division and tell them that I made it to Special Forces selection. I'm out of here. Like, I'm gone. I was pretty proud then, because I was ready to see that platoon and that company in my rearview mirror. I was ready to leave. I was ready to move on to bigger and better things. But I was pretty proud when I was in Afghanistan, and I would train a group of soldiers or a group of civilians to become policemen. And then just randomly show up in their village one day and see them doing what they were trained to do. And they were doing it because, they weren't doing it for money. They were doing it because maybe I instilled some sense of integrity in them. I don't know. But working with those guys, and we would have graduation ceremonies for them, and the provincial leader would come in, or he would like shake all their hands, and they were, you know, so nervous because this guy is like the most powerful person they've ever met in their life. And you know, we'd kind of make it special for them, and like seeing the looks on their faces, like, you know, these are grown men. These are men that were in the Mujahideen, maybe. I had former Taliban guys that were in that I trained that had, you know, they weren't a part of the Taliban anymore. And I had older gentlemen that, you know, had fought the Russians and they fought Americans. I mean, we used to have conversations all the time about, I kind of laugh at them, like, I know you guys fought the Americans. I know you guys fought the Russians. Like, let's talk tactics. And we would sit down and talk about that stuff. I mean, these guys are hardcore guys. And they looked like 10-year-old kids standing up there. They were so nervous, and that I thought that was hilarious, and they did too. But I was proud of them. You know, it was kind of what you had worked for through the whole time, and in the qualification course and being in Special Forces. Like, it kind of came full circle. Is taking everything that you learned, applying it, and then it really worked. And you know, in retrospect, those guys went back into their villages and they went back into their areas, and violence was cut to nothing, and they were able to protect their families, and they actually had more family members moving back to their villages from the bigger city of Kandahar, and because their villages were safe, and that's a good feeling.
Okay. And so then, what have you done since separating from the military?
I moved to Montana, moved to Missoula. I've been in school for 2 years. pretty much 2 years. I've gotten involved with the Special Forces Association here in Montana, and we raise money and we take guys that are still in Special Forces and their families, and we take them skiing, or we provide, you know, kind of the Montana experience for them for free, and fly them out here, fly them back, provide lodging for them in the best places around. And I've pretty much tried to do every outdoor activity that you can do in Montana, but just be happy and be grateful. And I've moved from an area where people are critical to an area where people are accepting, and that I think that was kind of a big decision. So it's kind of what I've been doing.
Okay. So is there any message you'd like to leave for future generations who will hear this interview?
So there's some fantastic things about the military. I think it develops young people in a way that no other entity can, because it makes you confront uncomfortable situations and fear every single day, and you're tested every single day, and you learn to push yourself, and you learn to overcome, and you learn to get over whatever specific little hang-ups that you had whenever you grew up in Greenville, Texas. Well, those don't fly when you're in, you know, Fort Bragg. You learn to be completely selfless. You learn to be tough. I mean, but with that being said, I think the military is good for a certain amount of time. And then I think that person transitions into kind of like a greater understanding of what the military is really doing. And I think that that comes from maturity. And when that person figures out what the military is really doing, and they see the sacrifices of people to their left and right, sacrificing their lives, and it's really not paying off, and you see the bureaucracy, and you see the time lag, and the inefficiency, and the give a shit attitude, and the people that are just there to do 20 years so they can retire and get a pension. It's those are the unfortunate things. And so if I had a son or daughter, I'd say, yeah, sure, join the military. Hopefully we're not engaged in a war that is for nothing. Hopefully we're engaged, you know, hopefully we're doing something that is positive. But I think that for a certain amount of time, it develops that young person into something that they could not otherwise be developed into in the civilian sector. But once they step away, they need to step away and only maintain the positives and remember that they are in the United States or wherever they are. They are around civilians, and they can't maintain that military, whatever it is, that is essentially like a cloak of leprosy that you got to learn to let it go. But if there's a certain situation where your spidey sense goes off, you can reach back and you can grab those things that you've been taught, and you can get through that certain scenario and then go back to being normal. But you can't hold on to that military whatever it is when you don't need it, because it'll be detrimental. So
okay. Is there anything else that you think is pertinent to us that I didn't ask about that you'd like to talk about?
I don't think so. I think you covered a lot.
Okay. Awesome.